Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Salem Witch Trials remain one of the most mysterious episodes in American history. When children barked, yelped, went rigid, contorted, bled, and screamed, all without any apparent cause.
But the Puritan authorities thought they knew the cause, witchcraft, which was a capital crime. The legal code of 1641 read, "If any man or woman be a witch, they shall be put to death." And that's what happened as family members turned on each other, neighbor accused neighbor, and mass hysteria took over.
More than 100 people were named as witches and wizards in New England. 19 were hanged. One was crushed to death. And the reason why it all happened has never been completely answered or understood.
Now author Stacey Schiff takes up the story. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her biography of Vladimir Nabokov's wife, Vera, in 2000. She's also written about Benjamin Franklin and Cleopatra, among others. Her new book is called The Witches, Salem, 1692, and she's with us now in the studio. Stacey Schiff, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Radio Boston.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great. As I said, this this book is keeping me up at night, not because of fear of witches, but because of fear of what we are capable of doing to each other.
Yeah, that's what kept me up for 4.5 years as well, I have to admit. Right?
Yeah, it really is something. Well, you provide amazing, rich detail in this story, and just by way of example, I want to ask you about the story of Anne Foster, who was interrogated, convicted of witchcraft in Salem. I guess she wasn't executed. She died in prison. But the story is so amazing because at first she denies that she's a witch, but under pressure she begins to unspool what you call a fantastical tale. So what does she tell her interrogators?
She's a particularly compelling case, isn't she? She's an Andover woman, probably around 70 years old. We don't know why she's accused. And indeed, she keeps correcting her story and adding elaborate detail to elaborate detail as she confesses. And she's interesting for two particular reasons. One is that she's accused by her confessing granddaughter, who confesses that she's taken her to this diabolical Sabbath. And secondly, because in recounting this supposedly true flight to this diabolical Sabbath, Anne Foster not only invents the pole on which she travels, the snacks in which she inserts in her pocket.
Right, and just to be clear for listeners who haven't read it, she claims that she flew on a pole.
Sorry,
right.
Really important. She flies on a pole with a neighbor from Andover to Salem in record time, I might add, over the treetops with bread and cheese in her pocket. And the best part of all, of course, is that not only does she invent the flight, this bewitched flight, but she invents a crash on the stick. She's the only witch who crashes in flight.
So I'm just so curious. I mean, it sounds so crazy. How typical was this kind of bizarre story in these trials?
Well, I must say the narrative gets richer and richer as the summer wears on. Two things happen. Obviously, the first accused are in Salem Village. From there, accusations will radiate out to 24 communities. And by midsummer, by really August, the story has become much more fantastical, much more ornate. And the idea that this is not simply witchcraft, but a diabolical conspiracy against the state has begun to take root.
And it's interesting how this fear spreads throughout the community. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, because it really did affect it seemed to affect everybody. I mean, not just folks who were focused on these trials, right?
You know, it's interesting. Yes, because in some sense, everyone's life would have been affected. A community like Andover, which is particularly hard hit, the number seems to be something like 1 in 10 people were accused of witchcraft, most of them by family members, which is rather startling. But I guess I would read the level of how seriously everything was affected in the silence afterwards. There's such an inability to talk about Salem, there's such an unwillingness to want to face what happened after the trials have ended, that the idea seems to be that everyone was in some way or other complicit, whether he accused or confessed or simply failed to say a word in the course of the panic.
It's really, really interesting. I want to come back to these trials, though, because one of the things that you bring home so powerfully is once someone is accused, it seems all but impossible for that person to clear themselves, because alibis don't really work, because it was known or believed that witches could be in two places at once, for example. So that wasn't going to help. You couldn't protest a loved one's sentence for fear of being accused yourself. And you have this great quote that if you said something like, "I'm not a witch, I don't even know what a witch is," you've got this great quote from a prosecutor who says, "How can you know that you are no witch and yet not know what a witch is.
I mean, it just sends chills down the spine,
really does.
Doesn't it? Because
it really
it's Kafkaesque. It really is. It's the ultimate horror story. You know, when you're using what was used against the alleged witches is spectral evidence, which is to say evidence that only a bewitched person can observe.
Yeah.
And if that is the kind of evidence being used, there is no recourse. There is no alibi, obviously.
Yeah.
So the only way really to escape what accusation was either to accuse someone else or to escape the colony. And there a real class dynamic plays out. The people who manage to escape from prison or to escape accusation are generally fairly well off.
Can you explain this idea, how this fear of witchcraft was linked with the belief that New England was part of a sort of special mission, was in a way almost sacred? I mean, and therefore they were visited by witches.
Sure, and it's actually, I think, almost familiar to us, that feeling today. In the view of the Boston ministers, the idea that Satan had descended upon New England was proof of New England's piety. Mm. Of course, where would the devil attack but where he was hated most is the way that Cotton Mather, for example, will reason this out. So this is further proof that New Englanders are the chosen people. It's proof of New England piety. And I say familiar because there's a certain resonance there with terrorists are trying to attack us because they envy us our freedoms. Do you remember that kind of language?
It's really interesting.
It's a real sense that we are privileged in some way, and we are, it's exceptionalist American thinking at its best there.
Mm.
But yes, it is a great, it's welcomed in a way by the ministry, not only because it is proof of piety, but also because it has been predicted for so long, and it's a sense that the second coming might be at hand.
Boy. Well, you mentioned the minister, Cotton Mather, and I wanted to ask you about him because I mean, of course, he's famously been sort of regarded as responsible for this persecution. But I learned from you that he at first urged exquisite caution in this process.
Yeah, I'm utterly fascinated, I have to admit, by Cotton Mather's ability to speak out of both sides of his mouth. In a single document, he can urge exquisite caution and warn of these imminent invisible dangers. He's really the person responsible only, not for the trials, but for having written the most about the trials.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, for having written a very, very popular book about a prior case of witchcraft, which may in fact have inflamed some imaginations before 1692. So he's all over this, but it's very hard to tie him to this as the responsible party or even a responsible party.
Mm. But what explains how such a learned man, I mean, he was educated, among other places, in the Royal Society of London. There was no better education at the time, could buy into this.
Well, I think we have to remember something which is very foreign to us. The fact that witchcraft was very real to a 17th century, just to a 17th century man in general, and certainly to a 17th century New Englander who had no idea about skepticism yet, because New England was still so insular and in a bit of a time warp vis-a-vis England, for example. Witchcraft existed as plainly as did heat or light. Witchcraft was a known fact of life. It was the flip side. The devil was the flip side of a belief in God. So, in fact, this was not ignorance on Cotton Mather or any minister's part. It was part and parcel of the erudition. And these men, the prosecuting authorities as well as the ministers whom they consulted, were witchcraft experts. They had read everything everything there was to read in the field.
Mm. And you make the point that these educated people interpreted biblical texts literally as well, right? And you can find in Exodus, "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live." So they were acting on the word of God.
And what's really interesting when you begin to look at the court testimony is how often the accused, the innocents, are also quoting the same passages because everyone is familiar with this imagery and everyone is familiar with how witchcraft worked, both the accused and the accusers.
Another thing you do in this book that is so wonderful, you really paint a portrait of the atmosphere of what it was like to live in this time. You talk about the widespread fear of Indian attacks. You talk about the darkness, the cold weather, the brutally cold weather. And you write this about the Puritans: like any oppressed people, they defined themselves by what offended them, which gave New England its gritty flavor. I love that quote. But what was it like to live in this part of the world at that time? And how did these realities contribute to what was going on?
Well, there are quite a few factors at play here. One of them, as you mentioned, is the dark. It's truly excruciatingly, disorientingly dark. The Indian attack is a constant, and Indian wars are there is already an enormous amount of trauma about the prior Indian war, and there's a new one afoot. There's a sense of political and economic dislocation. It's the middle of the winter, the end of a very, very bad winter, in which firewood has been hard to come by, particularly for the Salem village minister in whose household the witchcraft breaks out. And actually, it took me a long time to realize that the repeated and somewhat petulant cries of this minister about, I need firewood, why have you not delivered my firewood to his parishioners, would also be an indication that it was cold in his house and that his family would be feeling that cold as intensely as would he. And, of course, that's where the witchcraft begins, with these two little girls beginning to convulse. There's also, though, a general sense of predators with and conspiracy-minded predators. When you read the Puritan literature, there's always a sense that you're under assault and that you could be attacked or undermined at any moment. Mm-hmm. You've set yourself apart. You're a city on a hill. Almost by definition, you're waiting for, you're a flock in the wilderness. By definition, you're waiting for the predator.
I see. So this really sort of feeds into that almost willingness to believe that. That need
to basically establish yourself as more pure and to somehow put a face to that invisible enemy in the backyard is very great.
You wrote such a fascinating piece, I believe was last week in the New York Times, talking about sort of our modern view of witches, particularly as the town of Salem celebrates them and looks at them. And here we are, Halloween is approaching. But I'd love to ask you just a little bit about that, how our modern idea of witches was created during these trials in Massachusetts, and what has become of that vision of witches in this whole era of our history.
It just was really important to me to be able to say once and for all that what we think of as a witch, whether it be Margaret Hamilton and the Wizard of Oz, or whether it be whatever we dressed up as for Halloween, is not what the 17th century New Englander had in mind. This was a religious construct. This was not a matter of superstition. And we too, by the way, have our delusions and our misguided ideas. But to be able to separate those two, but to talk about, too, about how we face history and how we've come to terms finally and after hundreds of years with this sort of epic wipeout in our history, using, oddly enough, fictional witches. It was Bewitched, of course, that puts the Salem witch trials back on the map. So you have a fictional witch somehow cleansing the history of these alleged real witches.
Yeah.
So it's just a funny transfer of the truth here.
Well, speaking of Bewitched, we know there's the statue of Elizabeth Montgomery there in Salem. But I learned something that I didn't know. I remember watching this show as a kid. You taught me that it was actually Bewitched that sort of came to terms in a pretty honest way with the legacy of Salem, in a way that few people have.
Well, there's this just hilarious episode where Samantha goes back to Old Salem, as it's called in the show, and sets our Puritan forefathers right. Here's what really happened.
It's amazing.
And that's something that a mere mortal couldn't pull off. You had to be a TV witch, or a fictional witch anyway, to be able to time travel back and sort of set the record straight. It's really kind of a stunning act of, cleansing.
Yeah. But I mean, have we really sort of come to terms with this? I mean, to see this modern celebration, which is really a festival in Salem, are we really sort of, respecting what was truly an awful thing that happened to people hundreds of years ago?
I don't think it's ever easy to commemorate an atrocity. I think it takes a long time for it to work its way through the system. This one seems to have taken longer than most. Salem has obviously attached something else to it, and I wouldn't want to confuse the two.
Yeah.
But that monument in Salem to the victims is really, in its understated elegance, is really, to me, just perfect, really.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I'm going to go back there and appreciate it with all new eyes, having read your book. Well, it's a great book. Stacy Schiff is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Her latest book is called Witches, Salem 1692. She'll be talking about it at the First Parish Church in Cambridge tonight at 7, and again tomorrow night at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. You can find more information at radioboston.org. Stacy Schiff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That conversation had me spellbound. Can I say that?
You're so sweet.
It's so true.
You guys both have the most beautiful voices. I sit here.
Well, we get to wrap up the show, so hang on.
Well, you can't run out of the studio.
Do you need my voice?
No,
sorry, I have
today.
Other places to go. I was hoping to brush my teeth.
We're just going to say goodbye very quickly. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.